And we're back with the Board of Psychologist Examiners. Ms. Poe, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Davey? Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Here.
Mr. Nguyen?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you. So let's go to the timed agenda item number 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding additional information received for complaint number 24-04 against Jared Deinhart, PhD, review of proposed consent agreement or possible acceptance of offered consent agreement. If declined, an informal interview will take place. So before we get started, I think the first item to discuss relative to this case is the additional information that we received from two individuals following the board's initial review of the case on December 8th. The board may recall that following conclusion of the initial review, the board forwarded the case to an informal interview and directed board staff to enter into potential negotiations for a disciplinary consent agreement for continuing education. However, new information has since been received. Board staff determined that this information requires board review for further direction. Ms. Michelson, will you please provide the board with the additional information that the staff received?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll provide the board just with a summary of that information. As you mentioned, following the case review on December 8th, staff did receive statements from complainant BY's mother and aunt. No documentation was included with their statements. However, it was noted that some of the information reported in their statements was information not previously reviewed by the board in some capacity. Specifically, some of the information contained allegations that Dr. Deinhart performed EMDR on mother and her husband, specifically in the Deinhart household. Also alleged that Dr. Deinhart performed EMDR services in other states for which he does not hold a license. There are also allegations with respect to BY's medical records being manipulated in some way to gain advantage in the ongoing custody proceedings. Also an allegation that Dr. Deinhart provided BY's medical record to the attorney of his son for the family law proceedings. Mother and aunt clarify that the information submitted was not a complaint, but rather additional information that could be considered for this current case before the board today. I did also receive a supplemental statement from BY that addresses the board's decision, along with concerns that she had related to her medical record. All of this information is included in the board's file. I did request a response from Dr. Deinhart, which was provided. It was noted that the allegations were denied in his response, and they also included a letter from the lawyer who indicated that he never received the medical records from any member of the Deinhart family. So this is just a brief overview, but please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Any questions for Ms. Michelson?
I have... question.
Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dunlap. Mr. Maxson, the accusations leveled about the records, medical records being provided to Dr. Dinar's son's attorney. Do we have any proof of that? Do we have any, or is that just an allegation?
Dr. Stewart and board members, it was an allegation. There was no supporting documentation provided to indicate that the medical record was provided to the attorney. And we actually, as I mentioned a little bit ago, we did receive a letter from that family law attorney. He indicated that he did not ever receive that medical record in any capacity. So at this time, there is no supporting documentation or evidence to indicate that the record was provided to the attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Maxson. That's all my questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. So at this time, let's see if we need to ask maybe the complainant or the respondent for some clarifications, or would the board prefer to have an executive session to obtain legal advice?
This time, if you wish, the board can decide whether it wants to take that initial information just as information provided by the two individuals. They indicated that it is not intended to be a complaint.
Okay, thank you. So at this time, let's see if, thank you for being here. Please introduce yourselves to the record and you may make a statement and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Jared Stark, I'm counsel for Dr. Vandemann.
I'm Jared Stark.
So, Mr. Chairman, we have obviously a statement about the consent agreement and the other part of the case. So I think Dr. Vandemann wants to make a general statement.
They're not on the Zoom.
Oh, we need to get them.
For those members that are attending virtually, we are just connecting another licensee to the Zoom. So just a moment, please.
All right, sorry for the interruption. You may continue.
Do the introductions again?
Yeah, let's just do everything. Yeah.
All right, this is Dr. Counsel for Dr.
And
so we have a, you know, a statement related to everything we've reserved to discuss with the court today. So I'm going to ask Dr. Backhart to read that statement, or would you rather me just address the additional allegation portion of the case right now?
Well, let's hear a statement from Dr. Deinhardt, and then we'll get back.
Is that the host would like you to unmute?
Yes, it's
okay. Yeah.
Do I need to reintroduce?
That's better. We can hear you
now. Okay. All right. So now I'm going to ask Dr. Deinhardt to make his statement. Are you ready?
And so, you know, I'm wearing hearing aids and I'm getting a lot of feedback, so I get a pretty big delay from what yours. Can you hear me all right? Okay. Nearly 16 years ago now, we met BY's family. We had them over multiple times a week for dinners, for Easter, Thanksgiving, Christmas, birthdays, family trips. We carpooled kids together. We have community choir together. Our families have been through health issues together. We have a lot of history together. Our home is open to them day or night. They knew that. Every time we offered or did something, they would ask, "Are you sure?" And we would say, "Yes, of course we're sure. I wouldn't offer if it wasn't something I wanted to give." Why did we do all this? Because we love them. Because we care about them. So much so that after 13 years, our son asked BY to marry him. We're so happy because she is an amazing young woman with talents, education, and they completed each other's sentences with songs. They are a great match. We loved her as our own daughter, and she told us she loved us as mom and dad. Their family was our family, and we knew each other in and out. So shifting gears, 13 years ago, my wife and I started our psychology practice, Ironwood Counseling, feeling that we could provide a service for providers that come to work and offer their services to others. Ironwood was established with the principle of doing things right and doing it well. We were determined to do that. So we follow HIPAA to the letter of the law, and contract independent providers do the same. We've worked with great providers who have helped thousands of clients who've come through our doors. They're people who I would recommend to anyone because they are great providers and great people. If my friends and family needed help, they're the ones that I would trust the most with that. So let's fast quickly forward to 2022. BY expressed things to us, our kids, her siblings, concerns that worried us. We suggested resources in our community through church. We talked to her as a family. She needed help because we were concerned that the consequences could be grave if she didn't get that help. So knowing she wasn't finding it in Utah, and because the family loved her and my son loved her, we were concerned that the potential consequences could be larger. So my wife and I offered to see if the amazing people we work with could possibly help her while she was in town. We were relieved to find out that there were openings, which is an anomaly, and let BY know and told her that there was room, but that she would need to call and arrange for an opening. We were relieved that she did because we genuinely love her and are concerned about her welfare. We didn't want her to continue down the path she was on. We had a lot of personal family issues that she'd shared, and we wanted to make sure she had help. My wife, son, daughter, her sister, and I acted as a family in good faith when we encouraged her to get help from the people, the associate that we're talking about. She, of her own choice, agreed to do so because I cared, because my wife cared, because my children care, because her sister cared and shared concerns with us. We loved her and cared for her. She was in need of help, and that's what we were trying to give to her. We've stood by her and her family through thick and thin. We talked till all hours of the night. We've gone through things at home, work, school, church, finances. This was not therapy. EMDR or anything else that we talk about was not therapy. This was a family. It was friends being with friends. It was family being with family. We talked, we laughed, we cried. We were angry. We planned weddings, and the list goes on and on. That's who the Dinehearts are. I'm not who she has made me out to be, nor is my wife. I have loved BY as my own daughter. What has changed over time is that she and my son are now getting divorced, and there is a beautiful 20-month-old baby that she walked away with early in July, and my son didn't see for 4 months, except for sparse video calls. That continued until a court order caused her to give him meaningful parenting time. That case is ongoing. I have no say in that case. The letter I wrote to them about my personal concerns has been addressed by the legal counsel and the letter that you have received. And I have not sent, nor has any information been used or will be used in a forensic capacity. It's time to stop listening to false allegations. The same thing is being presented over and over. Hopefully you've looked through these things and you can see that there is truth to be found here. This isn't about me and my family telling BY that she needs help and suggesting that she see the best therapist we know. It isn't about our initially getting her record, because she would have contacted Ms. Palmer if she really wanted it. This isn't about me. It's about her marriage and about the divorce she's going through. This is about boundaries that we set and kept with her family, and they weren't happy about. This is about her choices. And the best way to hurt me is to complain to my board where my hands are tied. So the best thing that I can do and have done is just provide you the evidence that I have, to provide you what I know to be true. So I've tried to defend myself. I've tried to tell the truth as best I can. I don't stoop to lies. I've given you what I have. You've taken your precious time. I've counseled clients and work meetings and sacrificed time so that we can defend what really happens, my character and the truth. Now you will need to decide for yourselves and to act on the things that have been alleged and look at the evidence that is presented. I've acted according to laws, ethics, and in good faith. I am a good person who has helped hundreds, probably thousands. Not once have I had even a negative Google review. I've never had a board complaint except one from a family member now that is in a divorce process. This is not my burden, and it is not your responsibility to discipline me for whatever's going on between her and my son. That's for the legal courts to decide. Your job is to protect the public, and I appreciate that. My clients are part of the public. My wife is part of the public. The people that I work with are part of the public as well. I've given the truth. We've talked about the statutes and guidelines. We are here to help people in our professional work. I'm not out to hurt BY. I don't want to make things difficult for her. She can say what she wants, but we need to focus on the truth. So here's what's happened so far. I've completed everything you've asked me to do, even the informal things. Her PCP was given her record within an hour of the finish of our meeting on December 8th. I reached out to her provider, informed her of the disposition of this body, and her provider immediately released the record to the PCP. That was acknowledged the following Monday. Later that week, on the 12th, sorry for that misspeaking, in a Gilbert court of law, acting as a witness for her mother, BY also stated that she had her record. I assumed that she had what she needed. There wasn't a rush to send it directly from our office because I heard that she had it. She also received a copy personally from her provider, Ms. Palmer. Upon return to the office after she and my wife and I, we had gone out of town for Christmas. After that vacation, I came back and received the inquiry from Ms. Stark that the board wanted to know about the disposition of the release to BY. I reached out immediately to Ms. Palmer to inquire and let them know that that was a question. She released the record to BY and ordered that the staff do that. I was following up as quickly as I could with the information that I was given. Once again, we're not here. This could have been a simple request. I'm trying to do the best that I can and deliver what we are asked to do as quickly as possible. I have not done EMDR with BY, her mother, her father, my children. This is the description she's giving, but EMDR, as with many psychological procedures, is not something that is done to someone. It is not an act that you covertly or illicitly inflict on someone. It is an eight-phase protocol that isn't done even in a brief encounter. This is a tool that you have training to do that can help people, especially that are going through trauma or things that are sticking them. She and her mother have participated in EMDR with their own therapist, with a treatment plan, with the goal, and it's obviously something that takes time. They are very familiar with how it works. I have told them how it works because I'm so grateful to have been trained with this tool, but I have not done it to them. This is not something that you sneak into a room and that you do. BY has provided allegations and disparate single text messages to try to make it appear as though there was some kind of illicit activity. There is no record, no history, no psychological intervention to her or any of her family members. They are family and friends that were in our home talking about life, and this was not intervention. This was not treatment, diagnosis, or any other psychological
Dr. Deinhardt, I appreciate your statement, but I need to keep the meeting moving along as well.
Thank you.
But I think, and Ms. Stark, please tell me if I'm wrong. There was a consent agreement that was offered, and then there were some suggested edits from, I believe, came to the board from you. For the board members in the packet that we have, in the 457-page document, it's around page 43, where you can see some of the red line edits that were offered to us for consideration. My question, Ms. Stark and Dr. Deinhardt, maybe either of you can answer, is after these edits came in, there was new information that came in from that was relayed to us by Ms. Michelson at the beginning of this agenda item. After that information came in, you signed the original consent agreement for discipline.
That's correct. So what my understanding from the December 8th board meeting was that the board was directing us to negotiate a consent agreement with staff. So I received the consent agreement. I sent back proposed changes. Staff indicated that they were not able to make any changes and that they would have to go before the board. So we did not want Dr. Deinhardt to lose the opportunity to sign the consent agreement because of the, I made some minor changes to the findings of fact. And so he wanted to show the board that he was willing to do the consent agreement. So we went ahead and signed it because I didn't want my changes to create to lose the opportunity to accept the offered consent agreement. If that makes sense.
So then the question, and just sort of like for my clarification, so the thing that we are looking at is either accept the original consent agreement because it was signed, or look at the edits that Ms. Stark offered on behalf of Dr. Deinhart, and see if those are the edits that would be acceptable to the board. And if they are, then, you know, proceed with the new agreement. If they are not, then we have the original agreement. So would that be an accurate?
That's a great summary, Mr. Deinhart. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. So with that in mind, I want to see if any board members have questions for Dr. Deinhart. I have a few, but I'll see if anyone else does first. Yes, Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here, Mr. Deinhart. My question is, what did you do that could have been perceived as EMDR?
I have no idea what they're referring to. Every conversation we had could have had to do with life and with what we were going through. EMDR, like I said, is a protocol, and most people think it's moving your eyes or using a buzzy, but that is only a very small portion. I don't know what she would assume that was.
Did you use eye movements with her? Eye movements?
No.
With her? Did you use the buzzies with her?
No.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. I see Dr. Seidman.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Deinhart. Dr. Deinhart, I'm looking on page 44 of our packet here, and I'm curious that you submitted a declaration in support of your son's dissolution, and you identified yourself as a PhD, and I'm wondering your rationale around doing that. As if you were only a family member, why would you put your credential on this document?
Dr. Seidman, if I may,
please.
We have addressed this with the board previously. There is also in the letter from the attorney that denies that she ever received medical records, there is also an explanation about what Dr. Deinhart intended to do there. But I'll let Dr. Deinhart answer as well, because I think this is your first meeting on this matter.
Yes, for the record, yes, it is. So, yeah.
So as we said in the previous board meeting, the intention wasn't to make it anything forensic or throw a credential around. I wrote that as the father-in-law. I'm sorry, I don't know where to look.
He's right there, but all right.
So there wasn't an intention to do it as a credential to be forensic or to make myself an authority.
Again, I if this has been addressed, please stop me, whoever needs to do that. However, again, why would one put their credential if you're a citizen as a family member in support of your son? I don't have a clear answer to that, why one would put their professional credential to that.
I'm sorry, I'm getting feedback.
Okay. Yeah, and Dr. Seidman, this has been discussed previously. I think the answer is that, you know, it was a PhD. It was not intended to be, again, in a role as a forensic psychologist. You know, he was coming at it as a father-in-law, and the fact that his credential was on there was not intended to indicate that he was offering an expert opinion. And again, if you look at the recent letter that we submitted for the attorney, she corroborates that to assume that this one declaration would unduly influence a commissioner or judge simply because the father of one of the parties has a PhD also assumes that discernment of commissioners and judges is easily swayed by honorifics. So again, it was not the intent to come across that way. And, you know, he has acknowledged that it shouldn't have said PhD at the end of it.
Okay, that's terrific. Thank you for the response, Ms. Stark and Dr. Diner.
Dr. Katarina.
So on the page one, we talk about that the records need to be released to the BUI and her doctor in an expeditious manner. That was the board's only. But they were released to the doctor on the 8th, and I don't know why at the same time on the 8th they were not released to BUI. You said you assume that she had the information, but wouldn't you automatically, when you're sending to one person, send to her too? So I don't understand why there was a month delay. That's what I got the explanation.
And there's a big feedback loop with your microphone.
Well, I don't know what's
going on. This microphone is not working. Oh. It's only for your Zoom and your computer. But they are still hearing.
Okay, should I say it again?
That's better.
You want me to repeat?
Please.
Okay, so on page one, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, it said that the records needed to be released to BY and her doctor in an expeditious manner. That was what we discussed at the board meeting. So then I see you fax the record to the doctor on December 8th. Why did you assume that BY would get the records from her doctor? Why did you not directly send it on the same day? Why did you wait a month?
Were you going to say something?
Yeah. So, Dr. Katarina, the motion that the board made at the last meeting, it said that the PCP records have to be released forthwith. Right. And then there was conversation amongst the board members that the records did not need to directly be released to BY immediately because of potentially sensitive information, which we talked about is allowed to be reviewed per statute to determine whether it is appropriate to release it to the person individually. So based on the commentary of the board members, and I have the motion said the records have to be released to the PCP forthwith, and it was not specifically indicated that there was a certain timeline that the board was concerned about regarding the records to BY personally. Now, Dr. Deinhart still wanted Ms. Palmer to review the records before they were released per statute. And so with the holidays and everything, he contacted Ms. Palmer when she was available. She reviewed the records. They went out to BY. And then I don't have personal knowledge of this, but Dr. Deinhart also had a court proceeding involving BY where she represented in court the following week after the December 8th meeting that she did in fact have her record. So yeah, that's the answer.
But why did Ms. Palmer have to review the records for BY but not for the medical doctor?
Do you want me to answer?
Please,
okay.
I'll add a comment.
So per statutes, there is some discretion that the provider has to review a patient's records to determine whether there's anything damaging in the records that could cause harm to the patient or a third party if released to the patient. So the provider is given discretion by our statute to review and determine whether it's appropriate for the patient or client to get the records personally. That same discretion is not required when you're releasing it to another medical doctor.
Dr. Stewart, did you have anything to add?
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman. Yes, that's my understanding as well, Ms. Stark. And also it's common practice that we simply do not release records without the provider going over the records to ensure that anything of critical importance is addressed when the records are released. So that's not an uncommon thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Flint?
Yes. Just to follow up to Dr. Medina's question earlier about the EMDR. Last time we were together, there was some discussion about the term EMDR being used more in a colloquial, family-ish communication style. I think that speaks to Dr. Medina's question a bit as well. If there was a chance for a misunderstanding what was happening, is that a component of
this misunderstanding. They thought they were getting EMDR, but really it was family discussion. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
I don't know that that would be a component, a colloquialism. Like I said, anytime someone says, oh, I stubbed my toe, we're like, okay, EMDR it. Mm-hmm. So this would be a similar, say, it's that idea of you've got trauma, let's do trauma. That's a joke. That's not a saying, how would we do EMDR? Was it performed on anyone? So there would be no misunderstanding that we set time aside, we are going to follow a protocol and engage in an act that would resolve or address or treat or diagnose anything.
But you are, there was a time in the family that EMDR was used as a, just as a part of conversation, not it's actually about constantly, the treatment.
Constantly okay. A part of that.
Okay. Thank you.
So my sort of questions relate to the consent agreement. I mean, at least from sort of my perspective, a consent agreement was offered and it was signed. So, I mean, I'm looking at it from sort of like an open and shut perspective at this point. There is an agreement in place and it's a disciplinary consent agreement. So I think what I'm struggling to understand is what sort of actions do you want the board to take at this point, other than just, you know, meet the conditions expressed in the original consent agreement? Because if the answer is that you do not intend to follow those terms, then we have to go to an informal interview and, you know, sort of hash it out at that point. So maybe this is a question for Ms. Stark. You know, what do you see as the best course of action?
Well, I think to the extent there were any, I guess, prerequisites to the consent agreement being offered, I think those have been fulfilled in the release of the medical records. So we are asking the board to accept the signed consent agreement to resolve the matter, whether it be the originally offered version or whether the board wants to use its discretion to look at my, you know, proposed changes to the findings of fact. And I don't know if you'd have to reoffer that and then have us re-sign it, or if that could be approved as the signed version. That would be a question for Ms. Galvin, I think.
You have the authority to accept the consent agreement that has been signed. And the alternative, if you accept the consent agreement that they countered with, then we would retract the original consent agreement and you would accept the counter.
So I think I'm prepared to go into discussion, but let's also see if the complainant BY is here, and if BY wishes to speak, now would be the time to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar, and I would like to thank the board as well today for letting me just have a few minutes of time. I would just like to address a couple of things that Dr. Dinehart did say in his statement. EMDR is not a joke. It's not a family discussion. The instance that I referred to specifically was only one, and it was very specifically with hand buzzers, and I had a text message showing we had a scheduled appointment to do that in his home. So he can say that. I know I have no other evidence of that, but EMDR is not the family discussion. He had flown to and other states those hand buzzers to do EMDR specifically for traumatic issues on other family members. I just wanted to address a couple of things very, very briefly. At the last board hearing, Dr. Dinehart has repeatedly gotten away with victimizing me as a patient in this matter. And it's not a family issue, because if this was just a family issue, I don't believe that it would have made it as far as it's made. He's gotten away with continue to victimize me again and again, outing my information publicly on board hearings, partly information that was false, such as self-harm that I've never done to myself. He has lied about things in statements to court signed as Dr. Dinehart, PhD. The records that I received this past month do not match what my condition would have been, how grievous my condition would have been. My records actually show nothing that matches up those allegations that. It also does say, very interestingly enough, that on July 6th, the first day I went into Ironwood Counseling to request my records, that my provider had given her permission that day on record for my records to be released to me. That did not happen. On July 12th, I went in again, and I will point out that what is fact, that on July 6th, Dr. Deinhart did call the cops after I left his office that day for having requested my records. On July 12th, he went to the Gilbert courts to file a false injunction of harassment against my mom. Why would I keep going back to that practice to try to get my records, which were clearly being stonewalled and giving to me, when I knew he was trying to take legal action? We did end up serving my mother that injunction in December. It was dismissed. The court saw that the evidence we had of what happened at their office did not match a word of the statements his staff had provided to the courts. Again, lies. My mother-in-law, Heidi Deinhart, was there the day that I requested my records on July 6th. She was there. Part owner of the business has said she has not been involved the entire time. Yet now she will be testifying about me in Utah courts as well, about my mental health, which again does not match up what is in the records I have since received. And they cannot provide my records that I've received as evidence because things would not be matching up. I think the biggest tell that something has been off, which has given me cause to believe this entire time, that for them to do the simplest of things, which was to release my records to me, when it is clear the excuse that they gave, that my name on file did not match up. Having now received my records, my driver's license was on file that says my legal name, Bronwyn Younger Howard. The ROI I had on file as well had both my married name, Bronwyn Deinhart, comma, Bronwyn Younger Howard signed. The past 5 months, I did not get my records. It was because the name on file did not match, or the records forms I had submitted were too confusing to understand. Well, if my mother-in-law was there on July 6th, I requested my records. And if both of my names were already on file, my driver's license was on file, and my provider had given record acknowledgement for it to be received to me, why did it take until the board ordered on two different occasions for me to get my records? And that is just a question that I'm still having a hard time understanding, because it can be said that these things were done with good intentions. I did not know the ethics. Obviously, I was in a very vulnerable state, like we've talked about. I don't know the ethics of a psychologist, but what I do know is that this was not with good intentions, because if it was, it wouldn't have taken them being strong-armed to give me just my records. That's all I wanted. I never would have had to file a complaint had I not been stonewalled and going above and beyond what a normal patient has to do to even get my records, to even change an ROI on file. That's all I wanted. Any normal person going through a divorce where your in-laws own your records would probably feel the same way. And I was acting as a very normal person, very politely requesting what I did. And it took, they tigered in, and it took until December for me to receive the very simplest of things. Everything else that happened along the way was just a choice Dr. Deinhart did make, that my original complaint was about my records. Again, if this was with good intentions, Heidi Deinhart would not have gone on July 9th, within days of me requesting my records, to try to get my sister fired at her job. They have continued lying to church authorities, saying that I have filed restraining orders against them. That is why I cannot, they can't go to church. I have not filed a restraining order. They have filed 3 against me, all of which have been dismissed. Again, the dishonesty, the lies of a supposedly trusted provider. If this was any other person, this behavior would have been completely unacceptable. And I do believe that because this is a complicated family matter, that the board does see it as something that can be very complicated. It's hard to understand. And there's a lot that's happened. A lot of misinformation about this divorce has been provided. I won't get into that because it's being litigated elsewhere. I will say again, because my in-laws do pressure, I was pressured into doing therapy at their office to do it where I didn't have to tell my family I was going to be there. My provider herself told me that the back-to-back EMDR I was doing with her every single day was very intense and would typically only be done in an inpatient therapy setting. And again, I just want to reiterate that I don't believe that this was with good intentions. If it was, Dr. Deinhardt wouldn't continue to get away with victimizing me as the patient again and again, have no apology, no remorse, only do things after the fact to correct behavior only because it was suitable to him to protect his reputation, not to apologize to the patient, not to realize that maybe he could have gotten away with breaking some ethics. Why does he continue to get away with continuously lying, and with his wife to continue to get away with lying? It should be seen as being pretty problematic. Again, I want to reiterate that this entire situation has been pretty traumatizing for me as a patient. This has not even been with the divorce, just this alone, dealing separately from that. This is entirely unacceptable. My family, apart from me, has been terrified because of their own actions, going after their jobs, filing false injunctions of harassment. For what reason? I don't understand. It is obvious that I did not make this a family issue. Dr. Deinhardt chose from the beginning, by calling the cops the first day that I showed up, just for simply requesting a change of ROI, requesting my records, and refusing.
BY, thank you. Thank you for your statement. We got the message. So at this time, let's see. I see Dr. Caterino's hand up. No, sorry. Okay, Mr. Nguyen.
Yes, Chair. Not to dismiss the gravity of these issues before us, but recognizing we've had lengthy discussions on this, I'd like to entertain a motion if the board would allow that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Nguyen. Dr. Stewart?
Oh, thank you, Chair. I was going to ask BY, in what way were your records altered? You said it didn't match the condition that you have. But in what way were your records altered?
I don't have concrete evidence that they were altered. It was suspected along the way just by me because of actions along the way that could have been the case for not being given them. It didn't make sense why. And the biggest example of that would be in his affidavit to the Utah courts. Dr. Deinhardt had said threats or attempts of self-harm and suicide. And I'd never attempted self-harm in my life, and when I received my records back, it also said I had never been at every time, every session. It was checked by my provider that I was not a threat to myself and not a threat to others. There was no plausible threat of suicide or anything of that nature. So with Dr. Deinhardt along the way trying to say that my condition was so at stake, that's why everything happened the way it did. And the records that I've received back just don't match what he has been saying along the way. So that's what that was meaning. No evidence that he himself has actually altered my records. But again, he had said he had clean hands along the way. But at the last hearing, it was noted that he had seen my records on December 22nd, very soon after I started therapy. So that's what led me cause to have concern.
Thank you, BY. Chair, might I ask Dr. Deinhardt a question at this point?
Sure, go ahead, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you. Dr. Deinhardt, in BY's records, would anyone else attempt to change or alter the records or delete anything other than the provider of Ms. Fong?
Would someone attempt to?
Has someone altered the records other than the
absolutely file, not
other than the provider?
There's a keystroke log of every action in every file in the EHR.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. So I want to make a motion, and then we can discuss it. So my motion is to accept the signed consent agreement as the final disposition of this matter. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Let's discuss this. So. in terms of discussion, I mean, as I indicated earlier, it seems pretty open and shut. I mean, we heard all of the concerns from BY. We heard what happened from Dr. Deinhardt. And, you know, we negotiated a consent agreement between our board staff and Dr. Deinhardt, and that agreement is signed. And any new information that we have received doesn't change the fact that we have a signed disciplinary consent agreement. So that's sort of my way of explaining why, you know, this motion sort of makes sense to me. Any further discussion? Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I absolutely agree that if the board staff formulated a consent agreement and it was signed by Dr. Deinhardt, I think that wraps it up pretty neatly. Thank you.
Any more discussion?
We'll get a roll call. What is this?
Okay. Let's do a roll call, Ms. Poe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Deinhardt?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
Mr. Nguyen?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. And just to wrap it up, there is no need to go into an informal interview because we accept the consent agreement as the final disposition. Thank you, Ms. Stark, for being here. And thank you, Dr. Deinhardt.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm going to give the next CE code word. The next CE code word is putter. Putter, P-U-T-T-E-R. Thank you.
Ms. Pakkinen, what should be the next agenda item?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to recommend item number 10. The applicant is, I believe, in the Zoom. Staff is verifying with that, and then counsel's still present. Oh, okay. Wait, she's not here? Okay. Can we check with her? Thank you. Unless it's under a different display name. Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm trying to, there's not much left to work with. Item 14 will require not an extensive amount of time, but if you want me to supply that by way of a filler while we wait for Dr. Berry, I can do that.
Sure. Let's do number 14, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed legislation. And all of those numbers are in front of you. And additionally, an update concerning the proposed executive budget for financial year 2025. Ms. Pakkinen, will you please get us started?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assure you I do not provide that such a comprehensive list of bills to torture you. I am just providing it in the spirit of being comprehensive. So yesterday I supplied you with, in your meeting folder, an updated report for the week ending today. So I think what I'm going to do is only report on those bills that have advanced at least through committee. And you can certainly read my comments and my summaries of the bills that have not made it to that point. And that way, you know, I think, you know, we're sort of addressing what is most pressing. With respect to House Bill 2050, that, of course, is the bill that this board is supporting for a collection of what I'm calling regulatory reforms, mostly around, primarily around new efficiencies for applicants for psychologist licensure. So I expect this bill to be to clear the final House vote sometime next week. I am hoping for different outcome than what we experienced last year, which is enough support votes so that the Senate will take up the bill. So I'll keep you posted on that. I've been in communication with our sponsor, and she's encouraged by what her colleagues have to say relative to their support of the bill. House Bill 2068, the Behavior Analysts Regulatory Board bill, that one, I provided you with a summary following the Regulatory Affairs Review Committee review, and it will be heard by the Health and Human Services Committee of the House on Monday. I will be there, as I'm sure the bill supporters will be. I believe that that review is going to be largely met with support, but the lobbying team would have better insights than me. The sponsor of this bill, she is a member of Health and Human Services, and I'm quite certain she's been talking to her committee colleagues about it. So I will give you a report after Monday. Any questions about those before I proceed? The next bill is House Bill 2100. So this bill really has, I see it in two parts. Part one essentially has, it's prescribing that licensure boards clearly identify on the website what are the application requirements by statute and rule to be met in order to be granted the license. I think that's a good thing, and I think that our board does a very effective job in already meeting that requirement. That being said, we can certainly take this opportunity to look in a more discerning way at whether, you know, we really are clear and comprehensive when we list the requirements. Of course, once someone accesses the application platform, they at that point see the requirements outlined, but providing that information ahead of or outside of an account login, that makes sense. So we'll be taking a look as this bill moves forward. We'll be taking a look at our website content and looking for opportunities, I guess, to do better. The other piece of this bill I'm kind of struggling with because it really does blur the lines, in my mind anyway, based on my understanding, that if the during the administrative review process, so this is the time frame when our licensing team, you know, perhaps me, we are looking at an application and we are identifying something about a requirement that we know that the board will have a substantive finding on. One example might be that the requirement is a letter of reference. If we see that the signer of the reference form is not a licensed psychologist, we know that that won't be acceptable to the board. So what this bill appears to do is discourage us from making that, sharing that observation or providing it in a deficiency statement or an incompleteness statement to the applicant, because we may be making a substantive judgment about that content. So this is something that I'm really still trying to process, the potential implications and how we might be forced to really make changes around what we do at the administrative level. What we don't want to happen, of course, is for us to knowingly send to the review committees and to the board applications that the substance of which it's clear to us that it won't meet the requirements, and the board has to essentially formalize that. And so we're issuing a lot of fair letters to applicants when that whole deficiency or that issue could have been remedied at the administrative level much more efficiently. Does all that make sense? So I think there's potentially some unintended consequences about this bill. But again, this is my reading. What I'm trying to do is understand more the intent behind this bill, and I haven't reached that point yet. So House Bill 2187, I know Dr. Davey has departed. He indicated that this bill, there's some discussion about this bill, at least in the behavior analytic community, around the use of appropriate titles. As I read this bill, I don't see anything that, you know, raises any questions in my mind about it necessarily, because there are provisions about the bill where it's prescribing, you know, limitations on some professionals' use of titles. But the way I read it, it simply says, relative to psychologists and behavior analysts, use the title that your statute prescribes. So I don't see any implications here. I will hear the testimony about this bill on Monday, so I may learn something new that I'm not thinking of. So I just mentioned it because of Dr. Davey relaying to me the behavior analytic community is discussing it on some level.
So Ms. Packinen does that, and again, we don't have Dr. Davey here for gathering more information from him, but it seems like they have the BACBR, the national title that they can use legally or under our statute. So maybe that is that what it's about?
Mr. Chair, that's quite possible. So, yeah, I think there could be some very interesting comments or, you know, speakers, you know, raising questions or commenting on this bill during the House committee testimony. So I'll be listening carefully and taking away maybe some conclusions from all of that. House Bill 2243, this is I call it the fingerprint statute fix bill that I've described to you. So that bill is moving forward. Quite unanimous support actually on that bill. So nothing seems to be impeding its progress. House Bill 2308, this is the bill that would prohibit boards from using an applicant's or considering an applicant's criminal history as a basis for denial if there was no connection or relationship between the criminal history and the license applied for. I don't know that that really is an issue that our board faces all of that often. You know, but it's something I think that we need to be paying attention to. I think this bill has a lot of support based on the little testimony I've heard on it. House Bill 2471, this is an interesting one in that the administrative rulemaking process would require legislative approval. So I found it curious that just in a very small number of states, very small, of which I'm aware, there is a requirement that the rule promulgation process that executive branch agencies, that privilege or that responsibility or that right that they have must then be approved or ratified by the legislature. So this would be, you know, shifting that, you know, to a dual responsibility or concurrence between an executive branch agency, a rulemaking agency, and the legislature. So I don't know that I've ever seen this proposal, and maybe I have and I just don't remember it, but that's one to take note of. Really what that would do, I mean, would be I think it would slow the adoption of rules considerably and, you know, thwart agencies' attempts to, you know, frankly, do rulemaking. So that would be something that this board, you know, may be impacted by. House Bill 2490, this bill would require that for a final administrative decision that's appealed to the Superior Court, It basically expands the opportunities for the other party to choose the venue where that matter is heard. So more of an attorney general's office, I think, issue, but also agencies, you know, need to be mindful of that potential change. Public records time frame, House Bill 2593. Usually we see some proposal or multiple proposals in some sessions that prescribe responsibilities on the part of agencies to produce public records. Sometimes there are time frames. Sometimes there are proposed penalties for failure to respond. So this bill does, it doesn't prescribe time frames, but what I see that it does is it requires more transparency with respect to the agency acknowledging, accepting, and communicating to the requester about their public records request. Ms. Poe, who responds to 95% of our public records requests, she's already doing meeting these requirements. So, you know, if they were looking at our agency as an example of best practices, well, then, you know, let's acknowledge that. So I don't see that bill really affecting us. Switching over to the Senate bills, there are just a few of those. The Senate Bill 1021, Scope of Practice Process Repeal. This isn't a bill that would really have any impact on this board. I think it's just of note that should any profession wish to expand its scope of practice, it repeals the requirement that there be a sunrise hearing for that. So basically, the scope of practice bill can proceed essentially without restrictions. Senate Bill 1153, this is the fourth year I think I have seen this type of bill. Basically, if an agency is going to adopt a rule that increases regulatory costs to the state, in this instance, it's $500,000 within 5 years, then the legislature must ratify that rule. That would be an issue for some agencies that need to raise their fees. If they need to raise their fees because their funds were transferred out of their funds, this could be problematic for those agencies. I have done just a cursory analysis, and I don't see that this bill would that we would not meet that threshold, that monetary threshold, $500,000 in 5 years matter. If I remember correctly, the version of the bill that reached Governor Hobbs last year was vetoed. So it's back, and I'm not sure if it faces, you know, a different, potentially different outcome. I think the last bill that I want to talk about is the House Bill 1249. So this is the bill that the Psychological Association requested, you know, that we've talked about now for a number of years with them as a very invested stakeholder. So I sent you a copy of the bill as it was filed, but I learned just a couple of days ago that the association has requested that it not move forward. It will be held. It will not be heard in this session. There will be more stakeholder discussions to prepare for future introduction in a future session. And again, we've been assured that we will be invited to the table for those discussions. I wouldn't expect us to be at all of them because a lot of those discussions are in relation to the other professions who have a vested interest in this area of practice, but the regulatory boards would be brought in for discussions at the appropriate time. So any questions about anything that I have summarized so far before I segue to the funds transfer discussion? Okay, great. So since I've notified the board about the proposed funds transfer, and again, this is a proposal. It was included in the executive budget proposal. We really haven't had any further, you know, direction, information, clarification, and so forth. So, you know, what I shared with you is still the case as far as I know it. I have heard a very little in terms of the response from the legislature. The chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee did acknowledge during a JLBC, a Joint Legislative Budget Committee presentation that, you know, this was a budget balancing strategy that was exercised in the past, 2009. And I don't remember exactly how he characterized it, but that it was unpleasant. I think that's fair to say. So I don't know if that represents, you know, resistance. I don't know if that means that this proposal will not be taken seriously or not considered. I don't think we can take that away. I think what we just need to understand and respect is that when the conversations and the negotiations, which they're happening right now, but when they really ramp up and when the budget proposals are emerging, we need to be prepared that this may be in the bills, in the appropriations bills. So I'm not sure that we will get much in the way of, you know, warning or notice. I think that, you know, we are just sort of in this place that we react to, you know, whatever information comes our way.
So, Ms. Packman, my question regarding that would be, do you and staff have enough direction, let's say from the board to have the flexibility to have any negotiations to the extent, you know, those negotiations happen regarding the funding sweep? Do you have enough support from the board on that?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and I really don't know. I don't have an answer for you. If the board were to take a position on this, I am not sure how that would be received. I am not sure how that would be perceived. I wish I could give you some insights and direction, but I don't have that. I can tell you that the associations comprised of individuals who pay the fees are, of course, displeased. And so, you know, I know they're having conversations within their groups, their interest groups and so forth. And they are communicating out that they would prefer that the fees that they paid to be self-regulated not be used for to balance the general fund. So I think that what has happened in the past is that boards have largely let those voices be the ones that are heard, and the boards, you know, we feel that we probably don't have the authority, you know, to really take a position or articulate concerns other than to say, you know, this may deplete our fund to the extent that, you know, if we become insolvent or, you know, something particularly dire occurs. In our case, of course, we know that our caseloads for complaint investigations will only get worse. The processing times will only get longer. Our ability to protect the public is compromised. I mean, we can say all of those things, but I really don't know how well that message would be received.
Thank you. Any further questions or discussion? Well, thank you, Ms. Packman, for that very thorough report. I always enjoy reading your summaries of bills in our packet. Thank you. All right, then what should be the next item on the agenda?
We have confirmed that the parties for number 10 are here and ready.
All right. Let's call number 10. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding psychologist licensure application from Emily Berry, PsyD, to include review of her self-report of criminal charges. Review of the results of the evaluation completed in accordance with the interim order for psychological or fitness for duty evaluation and possible denial of the same. For this, I believe Dr. Seidman is recused. Yes, Dr. Seidman, you're muted.
That's correct, Chairman Diner. I performed the fitness for duty evaluation for Dr. Berry, so I will recuse myself. However, if the board deems fit, I can be available for questions if needed as the evaluator.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. I think we should have you ready to answer questions regarding the evaluation. So please stay in the meeting in that capacity. But for the record, I just want to make it clear that you're sort of changing hats. You're taking your board member hat off and putting on the evaluator hat for us.
Yes, sir.
So for this, Ms. Pakkinen, will you please provide the board with a report?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So what I attempted to do when sort of structuring the memorandum for the board was to report the details or summarize the details of the history of this applicant and sort of separate between what has been previously presented to the board, what is known by the board, and then also present the new information, most recent information that has emerged that has it is just now being presented and reviewed by the board. So just by way of a quick history, and all this information is supplied in the file, Dr. Berry first applied to this board in August of 2019. She did disclose a DUI conviction from 2012. She was unsuccessful in her attempts to achieve a passing score with respect to the examination, the ECCC, under that application. And so she submitted another application in May of 2021. That application did report another more recent DUI charge from September of 2020 that was the charge was reduced. What we also came to learn was that there was also a charge associated in June of 2020 with unlawful violation of a fire ban that was not reported by Dr. Berry on her application. And then also in May of 2021, after the second application was filed, we came to learn that Dr. Berry was charged with driving with a suspended, revoked, or canceled license, which is a misdemeanor. Board found this just through our own research. Dr. Berry did not report this charge within 10 days as the statute 32-3208 requires. And so what ensued were staff attempts to collect those records relative to the charge, the DUI charge. And there were concerns that were raised about whether those records reached us in totality, or maybe they had been curated to some degree so that the board did not have all of the facts. We did eventually obtain what we believe to be the complete records. And so we did present this to the board on November 5th of 2021. In the meantime, there was another self-report. Again, this was not reported within the 10 days, but it was in November of 2021, a domestic violence criminal charge self-report. So On November 5 of 2021, the board reviewed all this information and elected at that time to approve Dr. Berry to proceed with taking the ECCC. And also, as was mentioned a short time ago, an interim order was issued to require that she submit to a fitness for duty evaluation. So the recent developments, in April of 2022, we did receive that evaluation, and we've acknowledged that the evaluator is present and available to answer your questions. And so subsequent to the receipt of that evaluation, we were awaiting Dr. Berry's next attempts to achieve a passing score on the ECCC. She submitted two requests to have extensions of time with which to take the examination, and both of those requests were granted. So in September of 2023, we learned through Dr. Berry's reporting of another DUI charge, in this case an aggravated DUI. What was interesting about this was that the event had actually occurred many months prior, almost a year prior, but the criminal charges were not filed until for those many months, almost a year later. And so they were reported to us in a timely fashion, but in the meantime, you know, the event had occurred almost a year prior. The police records indicate in this case that Dr. Berry had, she was driving intoxicated with her children, and the results of the blood alcohol test is reported in your report. And there are some other facts associated with the passengers of the vehicle. So finally, the ECCC score, the most recent one, was received in November, early November, and it did not meet the pass point. So Dr. Berry is coming before us today, and I think she and her attorney are best prepared to articulate what it is that they are seeking from the board. I have outlined some considerations that I know I have, staff has identified relative to what the board needs to consider. There is an open application. The application has not been resolved relative to all of the information that's sort of associated with it. We know with the application that there are no more available attempts under the open application to take the ECCC. Any subsequent approvals to take the ECCC would have to be done under a new application. I'm sure there are questions, and I will do my best to try to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Packinen. Any questions for Ms. Packinen at this time?
Okay.
Hearing none, let's go to Dr. Berry, and I see she's represented by Mr. Carey. Thank you again for being here.
Mr. Chair, if I may, before we proceed, I did ask Dr. Berry to turn on her video multiple times, but I'm not getting a response. So it might be helpful for her to do that now to the board.
Dr. Berry, if you can turn your video on.
I do not have video access. I'm on a mobile hotspot in a rural area. I was told that we would reconvene for my matter at 1:30. I was planning to be video available with my Wi-Fi at 1:30. So I did pull over, and I'm utilizing a hotspot with only voice at this moment.
Okay, yeah, I guess we'll have to make do with the technology that we have access to at the moment. So let's see if Mr. Carey wants to make a statement, or Dr. Berry would like to make a statement.
Sure, I'll make a brief statement. Chair Dinar, members of the board, there are some moving parts here. This is sort of a complex situation. when I am confronted with these types of complex cases, what I'm trying to do is figure out what's the most efficient way for us to deal with this. What I would suggest is the following. You haven't licensed her yet. And because you haven't licensed her yet, there's not a public health or a public safety issue where you would need to take immediate action. What I would suggest is the following. First, just to give you a little bit of way of background, her score on the ECCC was 470 out of 500. So she is within, is that incorrect?
Confidential.
Oh, I apologize. So she did appropriately on the ECCC such that she is within very close range to pass it. In addition, she has now since been sober, and that's been confirmed by what's called SoberLink, which is a sobriety testing tool. She has passed 1,038 tests at this point. I reran her report this morning. So she has been on SoberLink for an extended period. She's been on, she activated initially on February 27th of 2023. She had two instances where there was a test that created an error, but it was not an error based upon being impaired, but she did retest and it was cleared. So out of 1,038 tests, she had 1,036 compliant tests. So clearly she has now a path of treatment and sobriety. What I would propose, and also she does have an evaluation set with Dr. Keene, who is now a board-approved provider in March. So we have an opportunity to gather some additional data points at this point, and it is at very low to no cost to the board because there is no penalty to keeping an application open right now. Pragmatically, I'm trying to avoid further denials of licensure, which does end up on the data bank, and I'm trying to be able to give her the benefit of having a secondary evaluation. Dr. Seideman wasn't able to do a follow-up. Normally, you could send back to Dr. Seideman because he had made some recommendations, and then this new DUI allegation was made. So we could have sent him back, but because of his new role, we had to go find another provider, which is fine. We just were asking for the time to be able to do that. And I think, again, this is sort of this will resolve itself in a few different ways. Depending on how the Ag DUI case resolves, that consequence could either resolve more favorably to her or less favorably to her. So if she has a favorable outcome, then I think that's something the board should take into account. She has a less favorable outcome and she is indisposed for a period of time as a result of a bad outcome in her DUI, then that will certainly dictate what the board could do. If the evaluation comes back and she's deemed fit to practice, you have extra data points on exactly what does that look like. And if she's deemed by Dr. Keene as unfit to practice, then once again, you have your data points. So either way, you'll have a lot to work with at very little or no cost other than having to see me back here again once the evaluation is done. So what we're asking is leave this in a pending status, allow her to follow up with the provider. I'm going to need to defer in some part to staff about logistically how we would get her back on the ECCC. I think she'd have to actually apply, throw another application out to the board, go and go take the ECCC. But what I'm mindful of is how close she's getting to actually passing ECCC. I don't want there to be a significant delay in her going back and being able to test again. So logistically, we're also trying to find if there's any path forward that allows her to take the ECCC while the information is still fresh. And so I'm approaching this trying to be more pragmatic about it as opposed to coming here with a solution today. I'm coming here with, I think, what I see as an interim option. And again, this is all happening under the background of someone who's not presently licensed. So you're not in a position where these interim actions have to be accountable of someone who is, you know, treating patients or something where, you know, is working under your jurisdiction right now. So that's my wish list. I'm certainly happy to answer questions. I would just note the Ag DUI case is still pending. I advised her to not make statements about that. There is case law that says she is allowed to take the fifth without consequence. I don't want that to kind of cloud the issue. So if there is a logistical question or procedural question about the criminal side, I'm not personally doing that case, but my firm is, so I can give you whatever information you need about that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Let's see if any board members have questions for Dr. Berry or Mr. Berry.
Yes, Dr. Kennedy. So I'm not sure, are you suggesting that she would not reapply to the patient review committee?
This is where I think I have not encountered this part of it. So logistically, what we're seeking, and I think we'd need to figure that out. I don't know if the answer is she would need to file another application, which would then give her eligibility for the ECCC. And I don't know what the board would need to do with the matters, the items that it presently has on this application. But essentially what we're asking for is a mechanism by which she can take the ECCC again.
Well, as chair of the application review committee, we would have to, for anybody that does not meet the pass point, They reapply again, and it gets on the docket when we have time. So, you know, that's a matter of course, where I understand that they always reapply again.
And I think the vehicle by which she would need to reapply to get another ECCC opportunity. So she would be back before your committee.
Yes, if we go that route.
If you go that route.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Try to frame this,
but of course, Ms. Galvin, her advice is eminently more important than what I have to say. I think what the board is, the board has an application, an open application, on which there has been no action taken. There is no resolution, closure, anything of that kind. And it's an application that presents with a lot of different facts, you know, quite a history. And so I think that application and everything it includes must be resolved before the board could consider any subsequent application that would present her with future opportunities to take the ECCC. It seems that our statutes and rules do not allow her another attempt under this open application that was submitted in 2021. And I see Ms. Galvin giving this a lot of thought. So, and that is my inclination as well, that until this application is determined one way or the other,
it would be premature to file another application. I understand she wants permission and a means to take it into the committee, but allowing her to do so seems to close the door on the pending application and what is still outstanding. So I am trying to see if I can ask this question
in open session, because part of it is legal advice, Ms. Galvin. But is there any inclination on Dr. Berry's part to withdraw this application, and then that maybe leaves the door open for her to apply, reapply?
It's certainly something I could discuss with my client. If the board were to give her the opportunity to withdraw, then one of the ways I think this could be done is authorize board to accept the withdrawal. I could discuss it with the client, and then I think it could be granted, but I don't know if that's logistically if we could do it that way.
I would not recommend that she be allowed to withdraw her application than we have in the jurisdiction.
But you do regain jurisdiction over her in the event that she were to apply another time, and the materials in this investigation would still go to her underlying character, ability, and experience to be able to be licensed. So you wouldn't be, in my opinion, and obviously you'll get counsel from your attorney, but I don't, you would not lose, you, while you may lose jurisdiction over her at this time being, if she reapplies to receive licensure, everything that you have in your investigative file still becomes valid. It still becomes a fair game for you to consider.
Dr. Medina.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I view that as problematic, because if we allow her to withdraw the application without resolving this issue, she can go to Utah
and apply for licensure and not have to report any of the issues that we've encountered?
Well, she would have to report her on the Utah application the fact of a withdrawal. I believe withdrawals for this board are data bank. Is that correct?
No.
Okay. So she would at least have to report the fact of all the criminal charges, her history. And if they have an impairment question, she would have to obviously, if she'd receive any kind of care, be disclosing of that.
So if we do nothing, right, because she cannot take the ECCC and correct me if I'm wrong, if she doesn't reapply, right? So if we do nothing, what would be the next step? Waiting for this criminal charge to...
One of the options that Mr. Carey is putting forth is just a holding pattern. Let her get evaluated next month. And get that information, and then that will provide you additional data points and updated information. We also may have a conclusion or more information on the aggravated DUI.
And a little bit, sorry, a little bit of this is you know, it, for me is, you know, cynically, I understand with this current setup, where she is right now without the ECCC, with pending charges, what's not going to happen today is you're not going to grant licensure. So, you know, you don't have the necessary ingredients for that. So the idea is if the board heads eventually towards a denial, we want it to be an appropriate denial based upon the bases on which you're denying her, which is either ECCC, some of the violations, but it's fully cooked. We don't want to do that when we're in this sort of interim status of not having a complete eval and not having dispo on the criminal case. And so we wanted to make sure that if the board goes the direction of a denial, it's done in a way that gives her a path back with a lot more guidance and also is appropriately set forward. And if you look at everything and you agree that or you determine that it is not something where you want to deny, or if you do deny, but you deny on the basis of ECCC, then she can reapply. And we know what the rules for the road are when she does reapply, what you want to see. So I think we're in this sort of interim period right now. And because she's not currently practicing under your jurisdiction, there's really not a real loss if the board waits to get some more information. So that's really where we are is as Ms. Galvin indicated, we want to be on a little bit more in a holding pattern.
Dr. Medina?
I would like to move into executive session to seek legal advice, please.
Second. Okay, I'll give the second to Dr. Flint. Motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Then opposed, the motion carries. Just as a clarifying question, do we need Dr. Seidman for PHI? Just because it was your motion.
Not at this point. We can...
Board staff in event.
Yeah, we can add him.
We send him to the break. Now in my motion and
your motion to for legal advice and PHI, and if we need PHI or Dr. Seidman, we can bring him in. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, let's do that. Yeah. Okay. Ms. Poe, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Davey? Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
Mr. Nguyen?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. At this time, let's see if any board members have questions, additional questions for Dr. Berry or Mr. Carey. Hearing none, let's go into discussion. So would any board member like to start our discussion process? I can start, I think, I mean, given some of the concerns about Dr. Berry, I see sort of two options here. One is to allow a new evaluation, but keeping this application open. Or the second option is to deny this application because of the ECCC score. And, you know, that maybe gives Dr. Berry a chance to reapply, but the denial gets reported. And that addresses some of the concerns that we have regarding Dr. Berry just, you know, next day going to a different state and applying there and not having to report some of the information that this board has. So those are sort of the two options. I just wanted to get discussion started on that. Maybe there's a third option, but.
Personally, I'm just a little confused on how to proceed in terms of what might be the most appropriate course of action. So if there's a preference one to the other, I certainly like to hear that.
I have the same concern, Dr. Stewart. I mean, I can't decide between those two options. But Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is a very unique case with a very unique presentation. My inclination is to leave the application open, allow for the cycle fit for duty evaluation, and then revisit the case once the results are in. But at this point, I would leave it open until we receive that, which is more information. Because significant things have happened, of course, since the last evaluation, which was completed by Dr. Seidemann.
Mr. Nguyen?
Yes, I would agree. And even if you all would be up for it, entertain a motion for that.
Please do so.
Okay, I'd like to make a motion that, let's see if I word this correctly, that we wait to evaluate the application until we get the fitness for duty evaluation and you check in with us within 60 days, knowing the timeline.
A second.
Okay, there's a motion.
Second.
And there is a second, actually, by Dr. Yep. Katerina.
Perfect.
You could third. No.
I'll third.
Any further discussion? So the 60 days, Mr. Nguyen, just for clarification, would be the 60 days within which the board should obtain the new fitness for duty evaluation.
That's correct.
Mr. Carey, do we have a representation from you that the evaluation will take place, or do we need to issue an interim order?
You have a representation from me that she's set for an evaluation in early March. In my experience, Dr. Keene has been very efficient, but I didn't know if we needed to build any extra time for his report. I think she'll have it done in 60 days. It's more about when Dr. Keene will have the report to you.
I think we understand that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Then yes, you have a representation.
Just to clarify, also Mr. Carey just requested that you keep staff informed of the status of the criminal charges if there's any changes.
Of course.
Okay.
Any more discussion on the motion on the table? All right, let's do a roll call.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Katerina?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidemann?
Oh, he's recused.
I'm recused.
Thank you. Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
Mr. Nguyen?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous with one refusal, though motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So I think that resolves this item for now. Thank you again, Mr. Carey. And Dr. Berry, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to give out the next CE code word. The next CE code word is Birdie. Birdie, thank you.
Ms. Packinen, what should be the next item we should take up?
There's only one left. 18.
What's your name?
18. Only one left.
Yeah. All right, 18 is the only one that's left.
Yes.
Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding additional information obtained concerning Blake Harding, EDD, PhD, for potential inclusion into the notice of application denial or other available remedies. And Dr. Medina, since you're the lead on this, would you please get us started?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. In November 2023, Dr. Harden submitted a telehealth registry application. After a substantive review of that application in the January board meeting, the board voted on two actions. The first one to deny the application, citing findings that he does not meet the statutory qualifications of the telehealth registry. He made egregious and fraudulent attempts to deceive the board with respect to the legitimacy of his statutory agent and that he has established a practice office in Arizona, along with falsely representing to the public that he is a psychologist and falsely representing that he holds an equivalent independent psychology license in another U.S. jurisdiction. In addition to that, the board moved to issue a cease and desist order to Blake Harding for holding himself out as eligible to practice as a psychologist in Arizona. During the drafting of the notice of application denial, staff and legal counsel issued an inquiry to the State of Vermont's Office of Professional Regulation to question how Dr. Harding qualified for a telehealth registration practice authorization when Arizona's verifications of all his self-reported licensure representations in other U.S. jurisdictions found that nowhere does he hold an independent and unrestricted license as a psychologist. In their response, the State of Vermont prosecuting attorney responded that telehealth registrations are automatically granted as long as the candidates attest that they are licensed in another state with credentials that would enable them to hold the license in Vermont. When an applicant lies about their qualifications, the Vermont Office of Professional Regulation has the authority to take enforcement action to summarily suspend the license. There is currently an investigation taking place by that office in which Dr. Harding is the subject. Staff also learned that Dr. Harding had applied and been denied a license for massage therapist, body worker, or touch professional by the Office of Professional Regulation due to fraudulent or deceptive procurement or use of a license and advertising that is intended or has a tendency to deceive. This board's notice of application denial was held pending receipt of that additional information. In the first week of February, staff received from the Vermont Office of Professional Regulation a request for summary suspension of Blake Harding's telehealth registration. The basis for this action include fraudulent or deceptive procurement or use of a license, failing to comply with provisions of federal or state statutes or rules governing the practice of the profession, conduct which violates the ethical principles of psychologists and code of conduct of the American Psychological Association, incorporating Rule 1.06, cooperating with ethics committees, and 5.01, avoidance or false or deceptive statements. Conduct that evidences moral unfitness to practice psychology, and lastly, using dishonest or misleading advertising. Arizona Revised Statute 36-36A4 appears to be germane to this matter due to the facts noted above. This particular subsection of the statute establishes that one of the requirements to be approved for an Arizona telehealth practice authorization, the applicant holds a current, valid, and unrestricted license to practice in another state, which Dr. Harding does not hold. That is substantially similar to a license issued in the state to a comparable health provider, and is not subject to any past or pending disciplinary proceedings in any jurisdiction, which, as we can see, Dr. Harding does not meet this requirement either. The healthcare provider shall notify the applicable healthcare provider regulatory board or agency within 5 days after any restriction is placed on the healthcare provider's license or any disciplinary action is initiated or imposed. The actions taken thus far in Vermont were not previously known to the board and are being now presented to determine whether to include them as additional basis for application denial, as it fails to comply with a Arizona Revised Statute 36-3606A4. And this concludes my summary to the board.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Any questions for Dr. Medina at this point? Hearing none, let's see if Dr. Harding is signed in. If you are, you can unmute yourself and you can make a statement of up to 5 minutes to the board.
Mr. Chair, staff has been monitoring the participants throughout the day. We have not observed at any point today that Dr. Harding has signed in or been present for any duration of time. We don't see him at this moment. We do know that he had requested a continuance of this matter once he was notified that this new information was coming before the board today. He asked for a continuation. Our response was, we can't grant that. You need to present that to the board on Friday. So it's his request, his ask. If he's not here to make it, then I believe the board may proceed and consider the new information.
That's fine.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. So since Dr. Harding is not here and there is a request for continuation, my sense is that we deny that request. And my reasoning is, I mean, you know, we have given adequate notice to the respondent about the allegations and the new information. And I mean, I know it's an unfortunate situation for anybody to be in, and, you know, it's potentially embarrassing and all of that, but, you know, it's a process that we need to go through as a board. And, my inclination is to proceed with the underlying matter and deny the continuance.
Second.
Okay.
That's my motion. And then Dr. Medina, second. All in any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries.
Mr. Chair, may I supply just one more fact, I think, for the board to consider? So as Dr. Medina had indicated, she had summarized what are the actions taken in Vermont. And then when citing the subsection of the statute, the provision that the licensee inform the board, the applicant informed the board within 5 days of action taken. So we know that the summary suspension issued in Vermont that dated on February 2nd, today being the 9th, it would seem that, you know, that 5 days has already run.
Yeah, thank you for that additional information, Ms. Pakkanen.
Mr.
Discussion item, Dr. Carino.
I was wondering if we need to report this to the police because on his website, he says that he's a psychologist and practicing without a license.
And that could be grounds for the board's denial. And if that is the final decision, we can make referral to the Attorney General's office. So that is something that the board wishes to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Dr. Stenhoff?
I was just actually going to say the same thing that Dr. Caterino was looking at. I was just looking at his website, and he is selling himself as able to take care of a lot of various things besides even psychology, which is concerning if people are making appointments with him in regard to other industries. I'll say it that way. So,
Dr. Seidman?
And to add to those two comments, this individual is also in violation of R426303 titles. On his website, he talks about also being a PhD candidate, and we can't claim a potential or future degree or qualification. That's a violation of this particular ARS 322061 as well.
Dr. Katerina?
I'm wondering if also the Sesame Care needs to be notified.
Dr. Caterina, could you please repeat that? We could not hear you down here.
I'm sorry. I wondered if SesameCare.com
needs to be notified. Because that is I've actually used it. It's a place where you can have medical or psychological appointments online. And so they may not realize that he's not licensed.
Mr. Chair, to speak to that, what we believe or understand to be the case is that, and Ms. Folks meticulously verified all of the licenses and authorizations that he reported on his application. We understand he does have a license to deliver services, LPCA, in Washington State. So it may be that he can continue, you know, that he can deliver the services he's authorized to deliver by Washington State, that it's appropriate for him to use the platform for that purpose. I don't know if I don't know if we should report to, I mean, this is a private company electing, you know, to use someone, you know, to approve someone to use their platform. I don't know.
So, I do think it would be inappropriate at this time to contact them and make that referral, because as Heidi says, he does have one license that he could be.
It may be the only one. It's the only one that we could legitimize at any rate. So if I could
help to make a motion that we report Dr.
Could
Hardy to the county attorney general.
Mr. Chair, could we address the motion? I think that we are asking the board to consider making, which is we have new information to add to our notice of denial. That new information would be an additional basis for denial. It's the discovery and the verification of the disciplinary history issued by the state of Vermont. Once we have the board's approval to add that to the notice of denial, the notice can go out, and then he's already signaled to us that he wants to have a hearing. And so that can proceed. And then on a parallel track, I hear the board raising concerns about how he continues to represent himself. So that can be addressed with separate motions. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Packin. And then I was going to ask, there is sort of a cease and desist component to this as well. And as Dr. Katarina was suggesting, perhaps that, you know, that cease and desist could encompass sort of making him truthfully state on all of these websites what sort of services he's able to offer to the public. So let's, yes, Dr. Medina.
Should we include in the motion also that he failed to report within 5 days the investigation from Vermont?
We can explore that and see how there is the additional Vermont history, and he failed to disclose a denial of one of his applications.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
No, that's all Vermont. It's all Vermont.
So yeah. Additional disciplinary history, a denial. And then the failure to report.
Within the 5 days.
Within the 5 days.
Dr. Flint?
Also, Dr. Simons, pick up on the languaging. That is a separate violation, correct? That he's using on his website?
Yes.
Yes.
Ms. Galvin, can you clarify what the next step would be? The board did issue a cease and desist order last month, which was issued to the respondent. So with respect to that issue.
We're talking about adding on to the notice of the denial. The second issue, we have already issued a cease and desist. It is apparent that he continues to hold himself out as a psychologist or eligible to provide psychological services. So that could be, if you determine that's a violation of the cease and desist, you have the option to seek an injunction in the Maricopa County Superior Court for that conduct. And you would also be able to refer to the Attorney General's office if you believe that there could be evidence that he is practicing unlicensed.
It would be Maricopa, but we also do Tucson.
The board is located here. We would be appropriate jurisdiction if we did it in Maricopa County. We do not have to do it in
All right, so I think let's take sort of different motions. The first motion is to include the additional information on the notice of application denial and the stat as all of the information that we have discussed.
And that it wasn't reported within the 5 days.
Yes. Dr. McLean has seconded discussion. So I think, in terms of discussion, it's a really unfortunate situation. As a board, we like to think that the applicants who come to us with sort of a baseline of goodwill and honesty, and none of that is really, at least I didn't see any of those qualities in this. So it's a really unfortunate situation that we have to deal with this kind of almost a pattern and practice of behavior, for lack of a better word. So I want to say for the record, I'm just disappointed in this applicant for trying to game the system. Let's stop there. Any more discussion? All right, there is a motion and a second. Do we need a roll call or can we do a voice? Okay, roll call.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Caterino?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
Mr. Nguyen?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you. Dr. Flint.
I would like to ask that move forward with the injunction in Maricopa County Superior Court and also referring to the Attorney General Office because there appears to be continued evidence of unlicensed practice.
Second.
Thank you. There is a motion by Dr. Flint and a second by Dr. Medina. And this, just as a clarification, relates to also the cease and desist order. So it's an injunction because he failed to comply with the cease and desist. Any further discussion? All right. I think, in terms of discussion, my previous comments stand. It's the same case, same matter. Dr. Seidman.
And I agree. And to state the obvious, to protect the public, this is necessary.
Yes.
I agree.
All right. Let's do a roll call on this motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Caterino?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
Mr. Nguyen?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So I think that concludes agenda item 18. On item number 19, I recall Dr. Stewart had recommended something to be placed on the next available meetings agenda.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. an exploration of the EPPP2 and ASPPB finally getting their act together to provide mock tests and or study materials that we can direct our applicants to.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stewart, so I'll prepare that March's agenda, of course, is one that we need to be, we have limited time. It may or may not fit on that agenda, but I will tell you that, you know, maybe we could have a short discussion around some materials that have been issued by ASPPB recently. What I have already prearranged is after the mid-year meeting to have ASPPB come back to discuss a related topic. So would it be okay with the board if we sort of include both topics together, even if it's, you know, 2 to 3 months into the future?
Yes, that's okay.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any more items that board members would like to place on a future meeting agenda? Hearing none, item number 20, it is 2:37 p.m. and I exercise my moderator's privilege to adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everybody, for making this meeting in person and for those who attended virtually. Thank you, everybody, for your hard work.
Thank you.
Thank you to staff.